I'm Brian Russo, and welcome back to Coastal Connection. For the next few minutes, we're going to spend some time on the Delmarva Peninsula's longest river, the Choptank. I'm on a boat with Drew Coslow, the Choptank's riverkeeper, and officials from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We're cruising the Choptank near Easton in Talbot County on a gorgeous morning earlier this week, zipping past awe-inspiring waterfront estates, recreational boaters, and the occasional crab fisherman. We're headed to a new vertical profiler in the river that NOAA officials placed a few weeks ago. But more about that in a minute. Let's talk about the river itself. The Choptank runs 71 miles from Kent County, Delaware, across Maryland's eastern shore before emptying into the Chesapeake Bay. Environmentalists say this river is emblematic of the environmental problems facing many waterways in our region. And that's partly why it was recently chosen by NOAA as a habitat focus area, which is just one of two places in the nation to receive that designation. Joining me and Drew Coslow on the boat today are these folks.
I'm Peyton Robertson, the director of the NOAA Chesapeake Bay office.
I'm Sammy Orlando. I'm with NOAA's Office of National Marine Sanctuaries.
I'm Shannon Sprague. I'm the environmental literacy manager at the NOAA Chesapeake Bay office.
Drew finally eases up on the throttle, and we coast toward a big yellow buoy-looking type thing. Peyton Robertson answers my question before I can even ask it.
So that's what we call a vertical profiler. There are a couple of these out in this general geography. There's one sitting down in Harris Creek here in the Tread. My office, NOAA, has put this one out to monitor water quality. And the reason it's called a vertical profiler is that it actually has a device that can go up and down from the bottom to the surface and measure dissolved oxygen, again, at surface and at the bottom. And as we know, as the summer months wear on, oxygen starts to become an issue as you get towards the bottom. We end up with this condition where the bottom water runs out of oxygen. It's either what we call anoxia, no oxygen, or hypoxia, very low oxygen. And that's a problem for the things that live on the bottom. And so one of the reasons we're interested in monitoring that here is because there's a lot of oyster restoration planned for the Tread, and we want to make sure that the conditions are suitable for them. And so that one's sitting in about 17 feet of water. We won't plant oysters much deeper than that because of that same problem. If they run out of oxygen, then they die. And so we want to make sure we've got sufficient oxygen for them. Generally, this time of year, water temperatures are starting to increase, right? So surface water gets warmer. Warmer water sits over top of colder water. It doesn't mix. And then oxygen slowly starts to decline until a point, usually in the hot months of the summer, July and August, where the bottom water runs out of oxygen. There's no real mechanism for it to mix because, again, hot water on top, cold water on the bottom, it doesn't circulate. And then as the fall wears on, surface water cools down, and that warmer water on the bottom then is free to rise and mix with the surface again, and the oxygen's replenished. So generally the trend we see is rising surface water temperatures and declining bottom water oxygen over the summer months.
Gotcha. Drew Coslow, I want to turn to you for a second. This is a stretch of water that you know very well. How is this river faring health-wise?
Well, the Choptank is one of the most productive rivers I've had the pleasure of working on still. Overall water quality trends are still on a downward spiral. That's a real challenge. That's a challenge of our organization, but it still remains one of the most important rivers for striped bass spawning in the entire Atlantic seaboard. And they harvest oysters in the river from Tillman all the way up well above Cambridge. You know, it's still a very productive system. The problem in it really is that it's a delivery mechanism for nutrients into the dead zone that Peyton was talking about. Yeah. And the nutrient levels are very high. They're rising. They're continuing to increase. And, you know, some people will say that that's 70% of the nitrate, for example, the nitrogen comes through groundwater into mm-hmm. the system to maintain base flow in the headwater stream systems. And people say, well, there's this lag time, right, between when nitrogen is applied to a farm, say, and when it soaks down through the soil to the groundwater and moves to the surface waters. And I think in some places there's a very long lag time, 10 to 15 years, in sandier soils and shallow groundwater. I think, you know, you see very quick movement of those nutrients.
This river and many of the waterways in our region have seen sort of increased nutrient levels because of you know, agriculture and real estate development, you know, stormwater issues, and, mm-hmm. and, you know, that people here on the shore know also well. I also read with interest that this river has lost you know, I think NOAA's estimates was 47,000 acres of wetlands.
Yeah.
You know, let's talk a little bit about the restoration efforts and what's being done here. And that, of course, leads us to the fact that this river is now one of only two places in the country that have been designated as a habitat focus area. Sammy, tell me a little bit about what a habitat focus area is and, you know, really the mission that's going to be going on here.
A habitat focus area is something that is relatively new to NOAA. As the name might imply, it's an area where we want to concentrate a series of resources and programs and people. For the entire evolution of the agency, they've done a lot of work in oceans and in the Chesapeake Bay, and there's a lot of different points of work that are going on. And the question might be, is there a way of maybe integrating a lot of that and bringing together programs and people in a particular place so that maybe we can achieve a little different kind of result and objective and success than you can if you're really kind of dispersed in the way that you're distributing those things.
Right. Talk about what's going to be done here in the next 6 months, the next year, the next 2 years to not only closely monitor the habitats and the species that are, you know, hopefully thriving and growing and flourishing here in this river, but what you're going to be looking for as far as that progress goes.
We're going to be doing a number of things. The entire premise is set up around habitat restoration. So there are a series of objectives that NOAA and its partners, and there are plenty of partners in this entire effort, will be looking at. A lot of them relate to oyster restoration. There's been oyster restoration going on in the Chop Tank, in the Tret Avon, and a number of other places already, and it'll be an expansion of that activity. There'll also be things that are dealing with wetland restoration, living shorelines. We'll be doing some dam removal for fish passage of important fish species. At the same time, we'll be doing a significant amount of monitoring, some baseline monitoring just to understand better kind of the landscape of the water and the watershed itself, and as kind of pre-baseline assessments before we do things like Peyton was talking about, that oxygen sensor right there, trying to make sure that we're at the right place. But an important part of what we're going to be doing and is really kind of in a parochial way protecting the investment. You don't want to make all this investment of knowing the partners without making sure it's got long-term legs to it.
Sure.
So a big part of what we're doing is a community engagement piece. Mm-hmm. And that really is trying to set up a way of engaging all a very broad swath of the community, all walks of business and demographics and the like, and trying to get them interested in trying to define a vision for what the Chop Tank could be.
Sure.
Drew kind of described the declining nature of it, but what's the vision for what this could be, and how do we all work together to get that done, and what are the pieces that everybody kind of wants to see? So that community engagement piece is going to be equally as important to a lot of the restoration and the science.
Sure. I want to turn to Shannon. I think that's a good place to segue to you. You know, as far as that education goes with the community, I mean, when people look at this on the surface and they know that there are restoration efforts that are perhaps similar throughout the Chesapeake Bay watershed area, is the first step of education trying to explain how this one is different?
We largely do education in similar ways around the watershed, and we focus on the individual characteristics of the watershed, and we use that as a learning tool. So we do go into community and look at the resources that we have, like the vertical profile, like the buoy, like the oyster restoration that we have going on here. We have similar projects going around in other areas of the watershed as well, like you suggest. We have 10 buoys up and down the Chesapeake Bay, for instance. However, I think largely we engage in a very similar way with communities. There's a model that we use that really looks at how do you work with the schools, how do you work with the businesses, how do you work with the churches and the community members to really create that shared vision Sammy was talking about.
And, you know, certainly where we are here, we drove past and sailed by all these amazing waterfront homes and properties. When you go out and you try to engage the community here in Talbot County and these people who, you know, the quality of this river and the aesthetics of this river are vital to, you know, sort of their second home or first home experiences, are you finding that they get on board very quickly?
Well, what we know is that everybody has their own way of coming to the conversation, mm-hmm. correct? What you cannot assume that one community or one community member is coming from the same place. So I think there's a lot of different perspectives, and that's what we're trying to learn more about here in the early stages of this process. And also that there are a lot of things that we can bring to everyone, regardless of where they're entering the conversation, whether that be data or resources to help them engage with oyster restoration, such as hanging oysters off their dock or things like that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City and 88.5 in Washington. I'm Brian Russo. We're speaking with Shannon Sprague. She's an environmental literacy program manager. We're also speaking with Sammy Orlando and Peyton Robinson from NOAA, as well as Drew Coslow. He's the Choptank River Keeper. Drew, I want to turn back to you for a second. You mentioned earlier sort of the declining nature of the quality of the water in the bay, and anybody who's seen sort of the annual grade of water quality in the waterways throughout the eastern shore of Maryland have read about that. Algae and the algae blooms have certainly been pointed to as one of the biggest, culprits of why that water quality is declining so much. What would you assess, the algae problem in the bay? Is that the biggest challenge?
I think the algae is more of a an outcome that we get as a result of the inputs of the nutrient loads coming into our waterways. And the real challenge for us is controlling those nutrients. Whether you're in an urban environment or an agricultural environment, you have to reduce the inputs to the system in order to get at the algae blooms. And the algae blooms are really, they're the thing that's preventing our underwater grasses from really recovering. So we see algae blooms, certainly. We see high levels of nutrients. We see low dissolved oxygen, but we don't really see dead zones in the Choptank. Again, the Choptank has a lot of freshwater flow and is pushing those nutrients out into the Chesapeake and feeding the dead zone.
Peyton, I want to turn back to you for a second because, obviously time frames on a project of this size and scope, it takes a bit of time to see an impact. I mean, what's the projected time frame to see the results that you're hoping for?
So with respect to oyster restoration, close by is Harris Creek, where there's been a substantial effort invested by the state of Maryland through the Department of Natural Resources, NOAA, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, along with a lot of other partners. That has been underway for several years, and we envision being able to complete the restoration portion of that project next year. So it's about 3 years to get that done in terms of a pretty major project. And then we have established measures or metrics to evaluate that restoration over time. One of those is to look at the survival of oysters after 3 and 6 year time frames. That ensures that they've had a chance to reproduce and produce another year class of oysters. So, that's the general time frame for a restoration project along those lines of say 3 or 6 years after restoration is completed to see if the oyster populations are still living. As far as the watershed and the habitat focus area at large, this is really for the long haul. So you've heard from others here that, in terms of building community support, understanding the causes of nutrient pollution and the sources and sinks for that pollution, that kind of investigation takes time, but ultimately to achieve the vision that Sammy described that we hope the residents of this watershed will be able to define, we're really looking on the order, I think, of decades. It's going to take time to create that kind of community support, and it's going to take time for the environment to respond. So we won't see things happen overnight, but we will hopefully see things incrementally improve, and that's really an incredibly positive and exciting thing to be working on.
Sure, and the interesting thing too is if the science of this and the effort is in it for the long haul, do you find that it's hard to engage the community on such a long haul when oftentimes statistics or progress is sort of immeasurable from year to year or month to month?
Yeah, it's absolutely difficult to have people see that longer term view because they do notice things in the much shorter time frame. But one of the things that we hope to bring as NOAA, as a science agency, is the ability to translate some of that science information, some of the findings and observations we're making in a way that's more meaningful to people at the local level, including local decision makers, right? So people who are working in local government or the county councils and cities that are in this watershed, they ultimately have to make decisions about growth and development, about how to manage the land uses that exist here, whether it be agriculture or waterfront communities. And so we really want to try to ensure that some of these businesses, like the watermen that are able to come out and harvest crabs and oysters, are able to continue. And so the science translation then equals being able to illustrate some of the changes in a way that's meaningful to those decision makers, to make better decisions, improve their decisions over time, to ultimately lead to a vision for sustainability. One of the things that I was going to throw in that people, I think, are noticing in this part of the world, particularly on the midshore, is change in water levels and these storm tides that come in that flood areas more persistently than they used to. So we know this part of the Chesapeake Bay area, and particularly the Delmarva Peninsula, is both subsiding and suffering from increased water levels or rising sea level. So that's something, the more I talk to people, they tend to notice. They're noticing that is changing. That's changing in their lifetimes. That's right. Changing in timescales they can understand. So signals like that in the environment then, I think, become important tools for getting those folks to really get engaged.
Since we're talking about such a big issue here, the Chesapeake Bay is such a large body of water, and all of the estuaries and waterways that sort of flow into it equally large. So with a project like this, where you're focusing on one area, do you think that that's sort of the future? To handle a big problem, you really focus on a lot of little places, and you grow it from there. Sammy.
We think that is one of the possible solutions for sure. I think for a lot of people, the scale and scope of the bay is just so big. It's very hard to keep their interest for a long period of time or have them care, even for a short period of time, of something that's far away from their backyard. And it's, at the same time, at the other end of the scale, there's lots of great little projects that are going on everywhere. But people may not recognize those or know how they add up. We think that operating at the scale of the Choptank watershed is kind of that Goldilocks kind of scale. It's just right. And it kind of puts together all those little projects, but keeps it kind of at the neighborhood scale. And this Choptank River, as Drew and others have mentioned, is kind of representative of the conditions, of the people, of the culture, of the heritage of this great area. And we really do think that this is one of the ways that we need to be attacking the problems of the bay, the health of the bay, and the way that humans interact with it, and safety and health of humans is ultimately the big goal. But can you get there by looking at it one watershed at a time, the way that we're doing it now? We certainly hope so.
Drew Kozler, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. You know, I've worked at the grassroots level most of my career now, and I do believe that by engaging a community towards a common goal is really the way to attack a problem. I think all, certainly, water quality issues are local issues. And I feel like you have to embrace the entire community and work collaboratively and cooperatively, you know, to achieve those goals. I'm really excited to have NOAA as a partner in this effort because, you know, the more attention we can bring and the more resources we can bring to issues, certainly the faster we'll see changes.
We've been speaking with Shannon Sprague. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Sammy Orlando is the liaison for programs and partnerships at NOAA's Chesapeake Bay office. Sammy, thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Peyton Robertson is the director of NOAA's Chesapeake Bay office and is the lead for the agency's Choptank River work. Peyton, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And Drew Kozlow, he's been our captain today, and he's the Choptank River keeper. Drew, always nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Brian. Thanks a lot for coming out.
To learn more about the Choptank River or the Habitat Focus Area Project, click to our website, wamucoast.org. Quick break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City and 88.5 in Washington. I'm Brian Russo. Don't do my love. Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do my love.